This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
Water, one of the most important elements to human life. Without it, a person can only survive for 3 days. Today, 7 in 10 people in the world have access to safely managed drinking water service, but what if you woke up one day and no longer had access to water? In 2018, Cape Town, South Africa, was on a path to becoming the first big city in the modern era to run out of water. It was known as Day Zero, the day the government would have to step in to indefinitely shut off its water supply to ration reserves. As conversations of Day Zero swirled and the threat of running out of water loomed near, citizens adjusted daily habits, cutting their usage by half and postponing Day Zero indefinitely. However, this crisis isn't unique. Sao Paulo, Melbourne, Jakarta, London, Beijing, Istanbul, Tokyo, Bangalore, Barcelona, Mexico City, and California in the United States all struggle with a similar crisis. Water has a significant value. Beyond drinking, water is also a critical component of sanitation. Unfortunately, 4.5 billion people, more than half of the world's population, do not have safely managed sanitation systems. By 2040, most of the world won't have enough water to meet demand year-round. In this episode, we'll explore how we got here and how we could adapt and improve to avoid this outcome. This is Spaces Podcast, where we aim to elevate the appreciation and understanding of the spaces we occupy every day. Hello, my name is Demetrius, and you're listening to Spaces Podcast. About 71% of the Earth's surface is water covered, so it may seem like there's no shortage of water on the planet, but when you break it down, 97% of that water is too salty to drink, 2% is fresh water, but it's frozen, and only 1% is fresh water that's actually accessible. As populations increase and climate changes, access to that 1% is becoming an increasing concern. Roughly 90% of the world's population is located less than 10 kilometers or 6 miles from a freshwater source. Historically, civilizations that harnessed water thrived, and those that didn't, failed. As far back as 2000 BC, ancient Greece and India had writings that recommended water treatment methods. There was an understanding of heat to purify it and sand and gravel to filter it. Interestingly, not much was known about microorganisms or contaminants. The main motivation for purification was taste. In the following 2,000 short years, civilization made significant strides in water treatment. There were also drainage systems, primarily intended to carry rainwater away from roofs and pavements. A notable example is the drainage system of ancient Rome called the Cloaca Maxima, or Great Sewer, which carried drainage water to the Tiber River. Built of stone, it is one of the oldest existing monuments of Roman engineering. After 1500 BC, the Egyptians discovered the principle of coagulation, a process where they applied the chemical alum for suspended particle settlement, but we'll come back to this process later. Sometime after 500 BC, Hippocrates invented the practice of sieving water, a method to separate the coarse material and trapping sediments that caused bad tastes or odors. Between 300 to 200 BC, Rome built its first aqueducts, and Archimedes invented the water screw, a large screw inside a hollow pipe that pumps up water from lower water bodies to higher land. Roman aqueducts, which were actually first built by the Assyrians, were structures that could carry water from one place to another. In Rome, these structures were large undertakings, more than 400 kilometers or 248 miles, and took over 500 years to complete. Most of the aqueducts were underground to prevent pollution and supplied over 1 million cubic meters or 254 million gallons of water daily. After the fall of the Roman Empire, many aqueducts were destroyed by enemy forces, and the method was no longer applied. The Middle Ages, or Dark Ages, from 500 to 1500 AD, lacked sophistication, scientific innovations, and experiments. There was little progress in urban drainage or sewage. Toilets were connected to cesspools, which were rarely emptied and overflowed. Most wastes were simply dumped into the gutters to be flushed through the drains by floods. Needless to say, this was also a period where diseases like cholera, dysentery, malaria, flu, typhoid, smallpox, and leprosy were common. By the 1600s, there was a resurgence of exploration and innovation in water treatment. There were early attempts at desalination, a process to convert salt water to drinking water, and the microscope was invented, allowing for the discovery and study of microorganisms in water. In the 1700s, the first water filters for domestic application made of wool, sponge, and charcoal were applied. In 1804, the first actual municipal water treatment plant designed by Robert Thom was built in Scotland. This water treatment was based on slow sand filtration and horse and cart distributed water. Some 3 years later, the first water pipes were installed. Shortly after, in 1854, behind a cholera epidemic that spread through water, it was discovered that good taste and smell alone does not guarantee safe drinking water. Water would require further purification, leading governments to install municipal water filters. Through further development and research, it would take until the 1940s before drinking water standards were applied to municipal drinking water. In 1972, the Clean Water Act was passed in the United States. 2 years later, the Safe Drinking Water Act was formulated. The general principle in a developed world was now that every person had the right to safe drinking water. To provide that right, it also became necessary to treat or purify wastewater to some degree before disposal. The construction of centralized sewage treatment plants began in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, principally in the United Kingdom and the United States. Instead of discharging sewage directly into a nearby body of water, it was first passed through a combination of physical, biological, and chemical processes that remove some or most of the pollutants. Wastewater treatment plants are large, complex facilities, easily identified by the series of large circular concrete tanks.
Those are typically the clarifiers, depending on the size of the treatment plant. You can see often a few of them together. Those are the clarifiers. And the blade is sometimes to skim off material from the top, but it's part of a larger structure on the bottom, which is, think of like a squeegee. And so think of a squeegee going all the way around that very, very slowly so as to not mix the water and thus negate the process, right? Because you want it to settle and sort of relax so these solids with the bottom. So it essentially very, very slowly wipes the bottom and moves all of the solids that floated to the bottom into the center and then those get processed separately.
To understand more about these facilities and their processes, I spoke with a friend of mine, Rory Harnish, who is a licensed professional engineer in the state of California, currently working as a project engineer managing capital improvement projects for a Southern California water district. Formerly, he worked at firms inspecting, managing, and constructing water and wastewater facilities, so he was a great contact to help provide some insight.
Water treatment is, if I can boil it down to one or a few sentences, is the method or process that we have designed to turn groundwater, rainwater, water from wells, streams, rivers, lakes, into safe, potable water. So when people say drinking water, potable water is safe for human consumption.
And then on the back end of that, it's safely disposing of used water, correct?
Yeah, and that could be, like you said, safely disposing of it or converting it into drinkable, safe water.
So you can convert used toilet water, right, into drinkable water in some cases?
Yes. In some cases, yes. That always tends to irk people when they hear that. In some instances, not this isn't straight across the board, but in some instances, the water that leaves your home can sometimes eventually become, through many, many processes, regulated processes, I should say, become safe drinking potable water. It can basically make the round trip back into your tap.
Yeah, that's hard to wrap your brain around.
It is. And I always think of my first reaction upon hearing that way, way back when. It's a lot to take in, right? You think, wait, that's dirty water. But if you were to see the process and see the entire process from start to finish, it's a long one, but it does get cleaned up.
Yeah.
It is safe to drink. I mean, we're doing it now.
Yeah. Can you give like a high level description of what the process of water treatment is and how that gets from point A to B?
So it's not always a straight A to B. There's a couple of different paths, and so I'll try to cover those as best as possible. I'll start with wastewater. So as the water leaves your home or commercial facilities, whatever it may be, it goes through like a wastewater treatment plant. And to give just, like I said, a brief overview, there are typically three types of treatments that it goes through in succession: primary, secondary, and tertiary. And essentially the water will go through a long process of continual separation of the solids and liquids, and finer separation processes. So primary process generally are just big bar screens to separate the larger solids that collect in headworks facilities and influent pump station facilities, the beginnings of the wastewater treatment plants. And sometimes they can go to in these giant round tanks called clarifiers. And so what these do is essentially let the water sit in the tank unimpeded and allow the heavier objects to fall to the bottom. And those get separated, and there's a whole solids treatment process, solids handling process that's separate from the liquid process. The secondary, which is my favorite, is more of the biological process. And that's where it gets kind of interesting, because that's where we introduce air and bacteria. As odd as it sounds, we introduce bacteria into the wastewater. And it's a special kind of bacteria. We like to call them bugs. And so what these bugs do is, with the air, they have a metabolic process that will further break down any of the solids that are in the water that are left over from the primary process. Once that's done, it's further separated, and oftentimes it can go back into a clarifier, depending on the process, to just let it sit and, again, allow the solids to settle to the bottom. Finally, the tertiary process is, if you were to imagine a giant cylinder that has sand and then sometimes charcoal filtering to further separate any of the really fine materials that were not taken away by the secondary and primary processes. Sand filters, and then sometimes it can go through a disinfection. So think of a big tank that's got a serpentine channel. And so you'll essentially dump in a fixed amount of chlorine and let it sit in the water and sort of mix in the water for a minimum amount of time, what is deemed necessary by the government. And that will oftentimes either produce recycled water or, in some cases, potable water if it can go further treatment. From there, those can sometimes, depending on certain circumstances, either be, like I said, turned into recycled water for irrigation, can be released in ocean outfalls, if you're near the coast, kind of like we are, or it can be injected into underground wells to let Mother Nature do some of the final cleaning. So that's wastewater. And so potable water, if there's a separate water treatment plant, not a wastewater plant, oftentimes this water can be gathered from underground wells, from lakes, rivers, streams. And it goes through about five processes. The first one is called flocculation. Flocculation is where we inject specific chemicals that will take any solid that's found in that water, and they will attract each other and clump into larger and larger groups. After that process is done, it goes through sedimentation. And think of something similar to where the clarifiers for the wastewater process, where it essentially sits in a large circular square tank for an extended period of time, and those heavier objects from the flocculation process will fall to the bottom and scraped away and separated and treated separately. So after that, it goes through a similar, like the tertiary process I mentioned for wastewater, into a filtration process, again using a sand and charcoal filters. And those again remove the finer materials before it goes into disinfection. And that can be chlorine, there's UV, there's a couple different technologies, but it becomes disinfected. And then it's ready for human consumption. So at that point, it's either stored or distributed through reservoirs, pipelines, and then eventually goes back into your tap.
This century, water consumption has increased sevenfold, but it is our inefficient use that is the biggest concern. Daily use of brushing teeth, washing hands, and toilet usage only make up 8% of water usage per year. Most of the water goes into industry use at 22% and agriculture at 70% for the food and products that we use. For example, Southern California uses over 2 trillion gallons of water a year to grow alfalfa for cattle. In some cases, there's just water wasted from poorly maintained systems. Mexico City loses close to half of its drinking water to leaky pipes. American drinking water supplies are among the safest in the world, but in 2014, Flint, Michigan began to discover how fragile that assumption was.
My wife and I went to a show at the Whiting Theater, and I remember using the bathroom at the intermission, and this was right at the beginning of all this. So I turned on the faucet at the theater, and it's just like blowing, just running brown, like super brown, rusty water, and I was like, wow, that's crazy to think about. And that was really the eye-opening kind of beginning.
That's Kurt Nicewinder, a local architect licensed in the state of Michigan and active contributor to his community, who utilizes his training to serve on advisory committees and provides pro bono services for community improvement projects with Habitat for Humanity and the University of Michigan Flint. Kurt shared his experience through the water crisis.
Flint is the home of where General Motors was founded, obviously a very big automotive town all across Michigan, but you know, Flint was really where they had a huge, you know, middle class base that was built on building cars and building parts that went into cars. And as a non-native, you know, looking from the outside until I moved here, you would hear on the news as they, you know, they would shut down factories as a lot of production, you know, moved overseas and out of the country. So Flint really was hit hard by the demise of the factory jobs. The biggest impact of that is really what people kind of call Buick City, but it's this entire swath of downtown, which I think it's like about 800 acres of now flat slabs of concrete that used to be multiple factory buildings for GM. And there was another supplier, Delphi, and then there was a Chevrolet site, all in the city limits that have been totally flattened. And with that went all the jobs and the population. So very similar, you know, just like in Detroit, you know, there is this massive decline in population, and that led to abandonment of buildings and abandonment of neighborhoods. And so at the last census, I think Flint was about 100,000, and at its peak was just over 200,000 population. So, you know, it declined drastically. And so Michigan state legislature created a law that allowed the governor to appoint a financial manager to a city or a school district or other large governing body if they're consistently not meeting their annual sort of zero balance budget, right? So if they're not balancing a budget and they're showing repeated signs of financial stress, the governor is allowed to appoint a financial manager, which essentially removes the power of the mayor and the city council from any financial decision-making process of the city. So, you know, it could be perceived as a very sort of egregious overstep against democracy, right? Because the emergency financial manager is not elected official by the citizens. They are appointed by the governor based on a criteria set by the governor. So at the time of the water crisis, I think Flint had at least, they were on to their second emergency financial manager. So there already had been a sort of building mistrust between citizens and government officials, especially the mayor's office, city council. And then now, you know, you introduce the governor's office with the emergency financial manager. So this sort of trust issue really came to a head with the water crisis. Once the citizens started to read about the decisions are not being made necessarily in the best interest of the citizens, but in the chasing of a bottom line. And when things really kicked off was when the emergency financial manager decided to, for the sake of trying to cut the city's budget and reduce their overall debt burden, they moved from the Detroit water supply to reusing the Flint River as the water supply, which the big difference there is that the water, the makeup of the river water from the Flint River is different than the Detroit supply, which comes off of Lake Huron. So another bad move of the automotive industry is it's primarily like factory site, industrial sites, is there's this chemical compound or compounds that exist that are, the acronym is PFOS or PFAS. And these PFAS chemicals, once they get into the groundwater and then they get into the waterways, so anything that is drinking the water, animals and humans alike, are starting to see really drastic effects at very small, this is the big problem, is that at very small doses. So even think like under 10 parts per trillion, it's seeing connections to cancer and then also defects in animals and things like that. And like, for example, the Buick City site here in Flint, in the past year or so, they've begun testing for PFAS, and they were discovering up to 40,000 parts per trillion all over that site. And that whole site is draining right into the Flint River, and it has been for decades. And so that decision to switch to the Flint River was not necessarily something like, you know, flipping a light switch, right? Just transferring the service or the source of the water. All these reactions then took place and started stripping away the lead or the phosphorus lining inside the water service lines. And many of them in the city of Flint and other legacy cities or Rust Belt cities in the country have lead service lines. And so that phosphorus coating was separating the lead line from the water source itself and, you know, basically created a protective layer. So a lot of this sort of science stuff is what we learned after the fact, but, you know, it can be very confusing to residents and businesses in the city to try and understand, right, when the country really never thought of, you know, where their water was coming from, right? I mean, we're a first world country, so we all perceive that we have the cleanest, freshest, pure supply of water. But in reality, what it exposed is this huge learning process that, you know, all of the infrastructure in the country is aging. So, you know, the citizens of Flint were really the first in the country to really have to learn about what's going on with the composition of the water and where the source is and how it's treated.
For more than a century, the Flint River served as an unofficial waste disposal site from many local industries that sprouted along its shores, from carriage and car factories to meatpacking plants and lumber and paper mills. The waterway also received raw sewage from the city's waste treatment plant, agricultural and urban runoff, and toxics from leaching landfills. The water subsequently became highly corrosive. The move to use it as a water source was categorically a horrific decision. Furthermore, inadequate treatment and testing of the supply allowed for the corrosive water to damage the aging pipes, leaching lead from those pipes into the water supply of thousands of homes. The presence of the lead would lead to a series of water quality and health issues for Flint residents. The water supply switch coincided with an outbreak of Legionnaire's disease that killed 12 and sickened at least 87 people between June 2014 and October 2015. Complaints mounted but were chronically ignored by officials. The foul-smelling, discolored, and off-tasting water that was piped into Flint homes for 18 months was causing skin rashes, hair loss, and itchy skin. Later, studies revealed doubling, and in some cases tripling, of the incidence of elevated blood lead levels in children from the contaminated water. Only through the determined, relentless efforts of the Flint community, with the support of doctors, scientists, journalists, and citizen activists, did this severe mismanagement come to light. In early 2016, a coalition of citizens and groups sued the city and state officials in order to secure safe drinking water for Flint residents, demanding proper testing and treatment of water for lead and the replacement of all the city's lead pipes and free water distribution centers or a robust filter installation and maintenance program. In November 2016, a federal judge ordered the implementation of door-to-door delivery of bottled water to every home without a properly installed and maintained faucet filter, and later in March 2017, required the city to replace the city's thousands of lead pipes with funding from the state and guaranteeing further funding for comprehensive tap water testing, a faucet filter installation and education program, free bottled water through the following summer, and continued health programs to help residents deal with the residual effects of Flint's tainted water.
Yes, so they started a pipe replacement program focusing first on the residences. And they started with using a really clever, I think, algorithm that the University of Michigan Flint, along with the Virginia Tech professor that really helped unearth this crisis as far as bring the awareness to the issue. And they did a survey of all of the, they tried to collect all of the data on water pipes and their age in the city of Flint. And then they created a kind of algorithm that helped them decide where to target replacements. And very early on, they were hitting, I think, like in the 90% success rate as far as discovering lead pipes, right? Because a lot of the city records were very sparse, and they were missing a lot. So they're really kind of doing an educated guess, and that led to a really high replacement rate, which was really exciting. And then over the course of years, and then transitioning in mayors in the city office, so there, you know, was a lot of changes in decision-making process through two different mayors, and as we came away from emergency financial management as well. So there's these steps to regaining control in the city, and as those steps happened, we saw more action in these pipe replacements.
While the situation at Flint is improving, with lead levels remaining below the federal action level, it is important to note that the federal action level for lead is merely an administrative trigger for remediation by the water utility. Health authorities agree that there is no safe level of lead in water. To protect our water supplies, it is crucial that we upgrade our nationwide water infrastructure, prioritizing the replacement of an estimated 6.1 million lead service pipes. Worldwide, as viewed by experts in the field, the top 10 methods to address the rising crisis are holistic management of ecosystems, improved policy and regulation, community-based governance and partnerships, improved rainwater harvesting systems, energy-efficient desalination plants, appropriate water pricing, improved irrigation and smart agricultural practices, recycling wastewater, innovative new conservation techniques, and education. In the end, changes in consumer behavior will have the biggest impact. Water is a valuable and fragile resource that many have become so accustomed to that we allow it to be polluted and wasted as water scarcity drives rising conflicts around the world. As a reminder, it is estimated by 2040, most of the world won't have enough water to meet demand year-round. Humans can adapt, but it is critical that we recognize this crisis before it's too late. That's all for this episode, but keep listening for a sneak peek of our next episode. This show is part of the Gable Media Network. You can check out similar content at GableMedia.com. That's GABLMedia.com. You can help support what we're doing here by leaving a 5-star rating and a review on your preferred podcasting app. It helps others find us, and your support is the only way that this show grows. And don't forget to connect with us through our Facebook community, Instagram, and see the random thoughts and articles that we share on Twitter and LinkedIn. But before you go, next time on Spaces Podcast.
You know, I think that physical spaces that are controlled by brands can be used for things that may not even be products. Like, there are some examples that we started to see of brands charging money to gain admission to what might have used to have been called a retail store. Like one of the spaces that we've had a lot of success with is a group called the Slumu Institute in Soho, and they're basically a slime experiential center for slime, right? But it is an amazing funnel into their store, which is Soho storefront primo retail on Broadway. But really what that's, you know, 80% or so of the square feet are used as a place for people to pay entrance and play with stuff.
And thank you again for spending some time with us. Talk soon.
Small firm entrepreneur architects, get ready to build a better business with the Entree Architect podcast, where business meets architecture. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, the host of Entree Architect podcast. Join me every week for inspiring interviews with passionate people that share proven strategies to help you build a better business.
If you think there is a problem, one, you can't make a move until you have a plan in place. The accountability chart really helps plan, okay, for the business 6 to 12 months out, this is what we need.
We cover it all, from financial management to marketing, sales, productivity, and beyond.
There's two sides of it, right? So there's the one when you don't have any work. So you're like, well, I'm either going to charge enough to be profitable or I'm going to go out of business. Or you have so much work and you have backlog and you don't need any more work. So you charge way more.
I'd also say lagging measures, one of the best. Like the best. So for any client, for any professional service company, if you're going to take one thing away from what we're talking about today, is to look at a number called the labor efficiency ratio.
Entree Architect is not just a podcast. It's your secret weapon for success. With over 500 episodes, it's one of the longest running architecture podcasts in the world. You're sure to find the information you need to elevate your business. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe now and join the community of small firm entrepreneur architects building better businesses.